Hey there, welcome to SaaS Unbound Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Dana, head of growth at SaaS Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful SaaS businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business a success. And today with me is Tom, CEO of Gecko Board, a tool for building and sharing real-time KPI dashboards. Excited Hello. To see you here.
You too.
It's like your second podcast ever.
I think third, possibly third. I think I'm with one.
Okay, all right. They're not all right. Still, I feel very special. I was like, damn, I have to get him. It's just a super cool tool. But, you know, before we get into it, maybe let's start with your background. Like, how did you get to do what you're doing?
Oh gosh, where do I start? So I did a degree in mechanical engineering. I was finishing that back in 2008. And I didn't know what I wanted to do at the time, other than I quite like the idea of working in software. And I really enjoyed the design part of things. And for a variety of reasons, I ended up working or getting a job as a UX designer at a company in Cambridge. And I was really lucky. It was a company that was really kind of on the up, had a really great culture. It used to bring out amazing kind of speakers from the US. And it felt like as close as you could get to being in Silicon Valley whilst being in Cambridge. I started doing that. I got given a lot of responsibility early on. Within days, I was designing things that were getting shipped. And within, I think, my first 18 months or so, I designed from scratch a completely new product and being like the lead designer on that for most of the project. And just got a lot of responsibility early on and just around really great people. But I quite quickly realized that, oh, wow, like UX design is really interesting. I really enjoyed kind of working with engineers, understanding kind of user problems, that kind of thing. But I was like, oh, wow, like product management, I've got a lot of sway over this. And I'm quite interested in that as well. And I was very numerate guy. I did a lot of, the degree was half maths kind of thing. I always enjoyed kind of looking at the data and ended up kind of getting more involved in that. And then there's a time when the product manager of the project left. So there's a gap there as well. I got more and more interested in that. And, you know, a couple of jobs later, I ended up, just doing more and more kind of product management. But then I kind of started seeing, oh, well, actually, like, I'm interested in this other stuff as well. Like, not sometimes the problem isn't a product problem. It's a commercial problem or a marketing problem or something like that. And I think I've always kind of wanted to go where I feel like I can make more of an impact, or there's more of a, that's where the challenge for the business is. And that I found that motivated me more than the craft. Like it's making an impact that I've always wanted. And so, yeah, when I wind forward a few jobs, I went and joined Gecko Board as a product manager. One of my friends from a previous job had got a job as a product manager there, and then he kind of convinced me to join. That was 10 plus years ago now. And then at Gecko Board, I'd got a lot of relevant experience in terms of the growing business and the kind of building out the culture stage and working cross department, kind of that kind of thing. Ended up kind of branching out more and more from product management there. In the end, I ended up doing operations and then became CEO a few years ago.
Okay, that's quite a story. And, I'm kind of wondering, on this story on your journey to CEO, going through different roles and taking on different responsibilities, what was the hardest for you to learn? And right now, being a CEO, what do you think was the most important skill? Like, is it something like, I don't know, like one bit that's so important? Like, I don't know, understanding the financials, or is it more of a kind of like having the idea of how business operates as a whole?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's being a problem solver. I think being able to execute is really important. I think, and I think that carries cross function. Like if you can get a project done in one kind of area, you can get a project done in another. I think just a general curiosity as well over what's going on and willingness to learn and adapt and immerse yourself in something. I think people skills are always really important, like being able to understand what makes people tick or coordinate across the business is really essential, particularly as you get more senior, being really proactive. But I wouldn't say there was any particular skill that was hard. I think I am in my heart a product guy, and I'm always conscious that And I think there's still something I haven't fully resolved is that, you know, that phrase, when your only tool's a hammer, you see every problem as a nail. I feel like product is still my hammer, and I have to catch myself to not try and always build something to solve something and realize that actually more often it is the commercial side to things. I've always felt sales isn't something that comes particularly naturally to me. I see myself as a problem solver, that kind of the art of sales. Like, it's incredible how a good salesperson, like how they operate. Like, it's an incredible talent and skill, but it's not something that I find particularly easy, but I force myself into it. Public speaking, again, is something I've never particularly enjoyed, like having to kind of do the company all hands and that kind of thing. But I guess you just force yourself to do it and you get better over time. And I think just brewing to get stuck in, making yourself useful. But I don't think any of the skills are that hard to learn. I think, or maybe just the classic management ones of, like, you know, managing a team and the complexities of that, that hardest thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, thank you. I'm glad I kind of got you to think about it a little bit. But, you know, one more thing that is very kind of interesting to me is that, you know, Paul, the founder of Gecko Board, he basically like transitioned out of the role of the CEO to give way to you. And, you know, this is a very common thing that happens in acquisitions, because we buy companies and we actually like when founders make themselves redundant for the company. So, you know, we make sure that whenever they actually decide to leave, there is an operating business. But it never happened for Gecko Board. You know, you guys never got acquired. But I wonder if you could walk me through maybe a little bit, like, what were the steps of this transition? Like, how were you basically baptized into being the CEO?
Good question. So I think Paul's always been thinking about, you know, developing the team, and I can't remember how long ago now, but years before it happened, he was like, "Tom, look, if we do get acquired at any point, I would see you as who I'd want to carry on and be around to manage that." So he'd kind of lined up that as being a possibility sometime before. And we worked incredibly closely, and still our chair, I still talk to Paul very regularly, and very close kind of team, very kind of huge amounts of trust, that kind of thing. So I'm very open dialogues all the time. I think just naturally, I, as I kind of moved into the operations role, I was doing a lot of the day-to-day type facilitating of, like, how we thought about strategy, how we thought about the day-to-day kind of operations of the business. I was doing all of that already. And then I think, but that's not to say it wasn't a big leap, because, you know, being CEO, all of a sudden you're accountable for everything. And before, I guess I had the luxury of the ability to do a lot, but not, that didn't necessarily start with me, I think. He also kind of introduced me more into the finance side of things before I needed to be aware of that. I'm quite like, we were quite a simple business as well from a financial point of view. You know, it's very, very typical SaaS, like, it's very predictable, there's not a lot of complexity in that particularly in terms of cash flow and things like that. But yeah, so I guess he was kind of readying me for it. And then I guess for about 6 months before Paul decided that he wanted to step back from day to day, he was kind of preparing me for that being a possibility. And I think, yeah, he went away for a month or so and just kind of left me kind of look after things during that. And yeah, so it wasn't, I guess, because I'd been there so long, because we'd worked so closely, because I was all over this, because there's quite a lot of stability in this as well. Like, the leadership team had been around for quite some time, and, you know, we were in a stage where the business was quite, we had the shock of COVID. COVID was bad for us and it caused a lot of upheaval. Ultimately, there was a core team that was been around a long time, who knew what they were doing. The core business was, the core product was established. We were in an okay place. So I think, but obviously I did go on a big journey. I think I consciously, and I don't know whether I'd do this the same way if I did it again, I consciously kind of communicated the change and phased it in a way where I wasn't suddenly going to change everything. It was like, look, I've already been in the senior team forever. I've been instrumental in setting our strategy. I'm not going to come in and then all of a sudden completely pivot what we're doing, or completely restructure the team or anything like that. It was, And that was there because we didn't want to kind of, well, one, we didn't necessarily feel the need at that point, or I didn't feel the need at that point. And two, I kind of wanted to kind of settle into it more rather than it be an abrupt change. I think if I were to go back, I might be more abrupt and make some bigger changes. But at the time, I wanted to kind of, we were still kind of the tail end of COVID. It was still causing some problems. I didn't want to kind of go in and really shake things up. And I think I had a lot to learn as well in terms of the bigger strategy piece, in terms of shaping the team to what we needed, in terms of making some of the harder decisions. I think in terms of, did we have everyone we needed to do what we needed to do? I wasn't ready for that. I'd never had to fire anyone or manage anyone out. Not really anyway, very kind of limited. And I think all of a sudden it's like, oh, I've got to handle all that. And it took me a while to, I guess, work out what I needed to do there, make some difficult decisions.
Absolutely. That makes great sense. I mean, I've been talking to all the CEOs who came over when the founders left the companies that SaaS Group acquired. And it's very different. You know, some just hit the ground running and they're like, okay, this is going to be tough. I'm going to be tough. You're not going to like, and like, a lot of the things that I'm doing, but I feel like, yeah, it needs that. And, you know, some others are a bit more cautious with it. And it's really interesting to kind of see and watch this transition and how this different management styles actually affect teams and the products in the longer run. So yeah, it's super interesting to learn about yours. But about change, you know, I want to ask you, because you also said you're still kind of deeply in the product, and, you know, Gecko Board is a PLG company, and it's been, I think, forever, right, since the inception. But I know that you guys have been kind of toying a little bit with different pricing and packaging and trying to add sales led to it. Was it kind of just, in a way, experiments to get over that COVID thing that happened to you? Or did you really think that in order to scale, you need something else? You need to bring maybe sales now into perspective? And how did it work for you?
Well, a few things, I guess. One of our challenges has always been that most of our buyers are coming in via SEO, word of mouth, and we attract quite a broad range of customers, and they pull us in different directions. So you've got, well, I won't list them all, but the variety of people wanting quite different things. And for the longest time, we were like, you know, maybe we're just a horizontal product like Notion or something like that for different things. And that's all right. And I think we were maybe in denial for quite a long time about our ability to serve and be a horizontal product like that. But the problem is that as soon as people want data, as soon as, you know, we being a KPI dashboard product, as soon as they want that, you can't just go thin, because unless you're able to produce all the metrics they care about and they're super accurate, then, you know, it's a fail. The product isn't good enough at that point. I think for a long time we thought, oh, maybe we'll be able to do it. Maybe we'll be able to build enough integrations, be quick enough to spin them up, make it easy for other people to create them, that this horizontal strategy is okay. And if that horizontal strategy is okay, then, you know, the go-to-market is SEO, PPC, like it's go self-serve. It's probably a lower value product. But I think we dawned on, actually, we can't do that. No one can do that. That's why there isn't a product that just does you can do every kind of dashboard and has every kind of data source that everyone ever want. So I think that took us a while of like maybe failing to achieve that and kind of growing up a bit and not being too optimistic about the ability to do that. And so with that in mind, we're like, okay, we're going to narrow it down. And then when you narrow it down in terms of who your ICP is and that kind of thing, all of a sudden you think, oh, wow, actually, like, we have this conversation. So I had a conversation with your customer going, like, you know, your pricing's unsettling. Like, they'd gone to their manager with a proposal to adopt us. And the manager had gone, oh, is that per seat? So, like, per agent that they have in HubSpot or whatever like that. And he's like, no, that's it. And she's like, per month? And he's like, no, per year. So we're like at least two, if not three orders of magnitude cheaper than was expected there. And yeah, I think that would have been too much. It's not right. But I think ultimately you realize, oh, wow, like the pricing isn't right here. And so that was one thing, just the focusing more on ICP, you realize actually, yeah, the pricing's not right. And we had a couple of big deal, like big names come in and like wanting all sorts of kind of enterprise sales type help, where we would kind of muddle by with the CS team, or you're getting me on the call or a VP of product on the call. And you go through that, they're really happy, we solve exactly the problem they want. But because of our pricing, they were able to subscribe for like $200 a month or something like that. This isn't good. So there's that one half. The other half, I think, is a sense of, this is where kind of your product kind of bias comes in, is that I always felt, and my kind of philosophy was, and I think deep in the company was, that, you know, if you build a product and it's usable, it should be self-serve. Like, you don't need like a salesperson. You don't need it in that process. It should be self-serve. And, you know, a big thing that we pitch ourselves on is that it's very, you know, we've got a very intuitive interface. It's very easy to build your own dashboard. You don't need technical expertise. But I think we'd gone too far, because ultimately it is quite a complicated market out there. There are a lot of different products, and it's not always obvious if you're not in it why this product is the right one for you or isn't. And also, we've made it easy to build dashboards, but that doesn't mean that building a dashboard is all that easy still. You still have to think a lot about the specific metrics you want, exactly how to define that, and then you roll that out and test it and make sure that like it's actually the team are engaging with it. And I think we are so much easier to use than most of the alternative ways of doing that. We were pitching quite heavily at that in our marketing. But I think forgetting the fact that actually like we could be doing a lot more to help people and help them get set up. So those two things co-aligning has made us want and start pushing more of a sales process. We still don't have a sales team though. We're doing it through our support team, and we're primarily focusing on inside sales. So people who have come in, they've started evaluating Gecko Board, and then we just help them at that point. We're like, look, help us understand what you're wanting to do, and we'll sort it out for you. And that's been something we've been doing relatively recently, and it's very encouraging so far, and we want to do more of. But we're not yet doing anything in terms of kind of outbound, and maybe we never will, I don't know. But I'm definitely a convert to the importance of a sales team and sales function. I think being that guide to walk you through the market, answer the questions, facilitate it, help you if the buyer has questions, prove the ROI to other stakeholders and stuff. Like having someone to help facilitate that is really important too. So yeah, those two things, I think, having the narrow ICP focus and then realizing that self-serve isn't always appropriate. It's always good to have self-serve, but I think sometimes it's not fully optimal. Like having help on top of that is really important. Yeah, so the other thing I did was just talk to other people, you know, similar places in the market, similar products, similar type companies, and understand how they were doing things. And that, again, opened my eyes to, like, sometimes you'd go and talk to them, and the face would just drop. They go, what? You don't do sales? What are you doing? Like, as if we're completely mad. And I think that, yeah, that's not always a good sign. Like, sometimes you can be doing something that's different, totally for good reasons. But I think it's like, oh, actually, yeah, I think maybe we've let our own kind of, you know, we're very much a product-y kind of culture. My background's very product-y. I think letting that kind of maybe shape our thinking too much, and actually kind of re-questioning that by having that kind of thought to re-question it through talking to other companies was another useful step.
Okay. Did you upgrade your pricing? That's the obvious question here. Like, is it more expensive now?
Well, no, we're still, because it's about getting it right for the right people. So we're currently going through a new iteration where we're trying to be kind of more generous at certain ends, but where we're doing a lot of work for you, or like there are things that you only need if you're a very kind of high-end, high data volume type customer, that we better capture that. But we're still trying to price ourselves. I think probably going to be still too cheap, to be honest, but we'd rather start there and then see, rather than you go in, you know, put a few zeros on the end or anything like that. And we still see that most of our money will be coming from this kind of mid kind of size deal, rather than tens of thousands of dollars a year kind of thing. But we want to make sure, when there are these really high valuable customers, where we can give them, we're giving them all the service on top of that, the, you know, real direct line to the product team, a real direct line to kind of really senior people, that service quality that we're offering, like making sure that we're actually, you know, pricing ourselves fairly there.
Yeah, perfect. All right. I mean, I wasn't like necessarily super surprised that you weren't doing like hardcore sales, but yeah, recently I think whenever I would talk to founders of like real PLG companies, we would always end up at, you know, we are thinking about sales, or we are starting to do sales because we all want to go mid-market or like, I don't know, up market or whatever. So it's very interesting how that shifts. And I think in a way, yeah, after COVID, everyone's kind of like trying to get to normal.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
Yeah, I think the other thing to mention actually is that, gosh, like 6-7 years ago, we did have a small experiment where we did hire 2 sales guys, and they were great, but it didn't work because we didn't mobilize. There wasn't a unified strategy around it. So we hadn't defined our ideal customers. They were kind of pushing in a different direction to what everyone else in the company was trying to do. They were going for these high-end deals that we had no real intention of doing a lot of the functionality that they were asking for. So it just kind of, it didn't work. Like, it wasn't really adding anything. It didn't make a big difference. And I think that so much of the language or conversation around sales is often like, you know, the BDR, the SDR, kind of all that kind of thing. And I think certainly for our stage, that isn't the right approach. I think this inside kind of, you know, they've already come in, they're already kind of trying the product, and then you're just trying to facilitate that is the place to start, not suddenly like getting a load of BDRs and doing a load of outbound.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to, you know, because you started talking about, you know, kind of educating customers and helping them, you know, set up the dashboards and everything. And I found, you know, I was looking for your podcast and I found Gecko Board's YouTube channel. And I was like, man, you got like 200,000 views on like dashboard design tips. And I was like, wait a second, how many people do actually do dashboards? So, but then, you know, I think it's so amazing. I mean, I'm a big believer in video content. For me, I'm a very visual person. Like, I need to see how it's done once rather than just hear like some instructions or read the documentation. So I think starting with video content makes a lot of sense for a lot of people. How did you end up there? And if you could tell me the people who are involved in video production, is it, you know, are you using freelancers or is it an ambassador in a way that you found someone who's been really into Gecko Board and now is doing content for you? Or is it someone in-house that you're producing these videos with?
Good question. So at the moment, it's on a bit of a pause, but we're going to pick it up again. Most of the videos were created by our former head of marketing. I think he had a vision for YouTube being like, you know, SEO is kind of beginning to struggle. Videos, somewhere we should be, there's a gap. He had an interest in it. He had an aptitude for being able to, you know, be good in front of the camera and put together interesting videos and produce them entirely himself, pretty much. We've tried a few things in terms of getting like a YouTube type influencer in the kind of dashboard space, which is quite niche, to create some videos for us in the past, but to limited effect. I think they weren't really, their audience wasn't really the right audience. We've outsourced a few things, but struggled, I think. But I wouldn't say it's been a runaway success either. And I think not because we just did it before we'd properly identified our ICPs. And I think the content that was maybe more engaging or more kind of casually interesting wasn't necessarily targeting either the right part of the funnel or the right buyer type. So we did quite a lot of content on data fallacies or very high level data dashboard type things. And that really isn't targeting our buyer really. I think it's time consuming as well. I think again, the head of marketing did a very good job of spinning it up, but I think we never quite got that cadence there that would make it truly successful. And I think when we have another go at it, I think we'll focus more on LinkedIn primarily and then shorter form, and then maybe have YouTube as the secondary thing. But I do firmly believe in video content. I think it's really great. I guess the other type of video content we created was these video demos of the product, which are very specific. It's like, how do I do this? How do I do that? And again, they've been useful, but less as a kind of acquisition type thing and more for using sending to try this and that kind of stuff. So some of the videos that have got a lot of traffic are things that we put in our drip emails as well. So people are watching those because they've signed up for trial and then we email them, rather than all being organic.
Yeah, that's great. And do they even convert? Like you were saying that maybe when you went with an influencer, it wasn't really the type of audience you were looking for. So those potentially didn't convert, but your own channel, do you track it somehow?
So I think we do, what we have, I don't know if familiar with the exact data right now, but what we do is when people sign up, we ask for that self-attribution in terms of where you heard about us. So I think YouTube did increase a lot. We're still a minority. Like, I think we're talking 5% of signups come from that. And then once you apply the ICP filter on it, because I think a lot of those, the ones that did really well were things like targeting more spreadsheet type dashboards, which is a totally different buyer really in use case to our ICP. Because like generally our ICP, we're trying to target leaders of support and sales teams. Whereas the kind of people who are mostly engaging with YouTube were more kind of lower down than that, like an analyst type person or someone who is trying to create a spreadsheet dashboard or something, or a marketing type dashboard, which we've kind of moved away more from.
Okay, I see. All right. So I wanted to also ask you about, scaling the company, because obviously, you've been around for a while. Mm-hmm. And, with scaling, this is something, again, that we mm-hmm. deal with a lot, when we get companies under SaaS Group umbrella, usually they're still kind of there at a startup-y level. So where it's still this bootstrapper mindset, and there are no real processes, and what we have to do to kind of bring it all together and maybe cut costs somewhere or like introduce different workflows is to really work on operations and introducing some processes. So how did it go with you guys? Like, at what point did you decide that we have to make it like into a real company and there should be processes and it should work as a machine?
Wow, I don't know.
Haven't.
Well, maybe I think that we quite quickly set things up well. I don't think it took, if I joined back in 2014, I would say that within like 2 years of that, we were pretty set up in terms of, having planning meetings, setting quarterly goals, having all hands, having people responsible for those things, being clear about what our values were. I don't remember that being that hard. I think what we potentially did though was we got a little bit distracted. I think when we had a period when growth was declining a little bit, or it was like, churn's going to catch up with us in a couple of years' time if we don't do something about it. But at the same time as we had brought on more people and we're kind of going through some growing pains. And I think maybe we got a little bit too, in hindsight, I think if COVID hadn't hit, it wouldn't have been a problem. But I think in hindsight, we should have been a bit more ruthlessly focused on growth at that point. But I think, I don't know, I mean, maybe it's too long ago, but I think it's never felt like, it didn't feel that hard, I don't think, other than maybe a few people issues over time, I think. And now, it feels incredibly established. Like, we know how to do stuff. We know, if we get an incident, we know how to deal with that. If we're hiring someone, we know how to do that. If we're doing R&D claim, we know how to do that. We, none of it is that hard. It's not a big issue. I think the harder thing perhaps is that you at that size, when you're kind of 30 to 40 people big, I think can be challenging in that you still have, like, your managers are still doing a lot of the day-to-day and kind of having to wear two hats almost. You've got a very strategic kind of setting the company strategy, the kind of all the kind of cultural piece, all that kind of thing. But then you've also got, like, quite granular in the meat. I guess every stage you've got different problems, but at this stage that's probably the hardest thing for us to manage, because you're neither, right? You're not a startup anymore, but you're not kind of full-on scale-up either, and you can't just, like, hire someone to manage something for you kind of thing. You're still kind of very much in there, and we're still making regular changes in how we do things, how we approach things, or strategy.
Okay. It's interesting that you mentioned that when you started introducing different processes, it was maybe a bit of a people issue and some people struggled with it. And it made me think about another challenge that we often discuss here, and it's hiring and, like, who you hire at different stages of the company. And, well, the common narrative is that there are more generalists at the beginner stage, and then the more into scale up you go, the more experts you get for different topics. So what happened with you? Do you think that those issues were because people were a bit more generalist and they couldn't just maybe keep up?
I mean, so a lot of this was back in kind of, let's say, 2017, 18, 19, where I think we did hire people that were too specific too soon. So I think we'd kind of got an idea over new things we wanted to be doing, but actually those things didn't have necessarily stability yet or weren't proven out yet. And I think we then struggled a bit because there wasn't that flexibility in some of the teams that we needed. I think it took a long while to get hiring right. I think we weren't harsh enough sometimes or strict enough in some of our requirements. I think there's a bit of a scarcity mindset, I think, in terms of, it was really hard to hire at the time because a lot of big companies were mopping everyone up. I think sometimes we were, oh gosh, like, we just got to fill this role. And maybe, I think also at the time, it was harder to get people with prior SaaS experience. So I think we often kind of gave up on the prior SaaS experience. And I think that was a mistake. I think also we learned over the years that with engineering, we went through a phase where we were like, we'll just hire really talented coders, but actually come neglecting, do they care about the business impact? Are they pragmatic like that? Do they want to have, are they motivated by making progress for the customers, or are they motivated by just, like, headphones on, cranking through some code? I think, and then also a problem we had a lot of time was hiring either front end or back end developers. And then we'd be like in planning and go, oh no, this project we want to do is very back-end heavy. We don't have enough back-end developers to do this. Let's pick something else. Rather than going, no, this is the work, we need people to flex to do the work. And again, it took us a little while to do that. I think going back, I would definitely have hired more senior people and maybe, like, and even if that meant hiring fewer people, I think we missed out a little bit there. And I think we were also a bit slow when things weren't working out to deal with that. But, you know, it's a real cliche, but it really makes a difference that you got to have the right people there and got to be bought into the mission. And you have people that are brilliant, but they're just not the right fit for you right now as well. And I think you got to be on top of that. You can't start a slide. You've got to deal with it, because it's the amount of time that goes into kind of dealing with the artifacts of that or managing that is colossal. And I think we went through periods where we kind of took our eye off the ball and made other mistakes because we hadn't dealt with it quick enough.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, it kind of, it is in a way common sense, right? Like, hire people who make sense for your business or hire people who are culturally aligned. But yeah, I think there are so many nuances to recruiting that sometimes, it's just, at least it seems not possible.
I've been astounded by the ways that we've been able to get it wrong sometimes, in that you just think kind of, the way it goes wrong, sometimes you just couldn't even anticipate that being the way it'd go wrong. But you live and learn, I think. And I think that you've got to accept that maybe your hiring process isn't always going to be perfect, but you need to be good at managing that and be clear with people and deal with it afterwards or not.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I just have a couple more questions for you, the usuals here. And, you know, the first one is, so far, such a long journey. You've seen it all, basically. What has been the biggest win and the biggest failure?
Oh, wow. I think for the company and for myself, I think that this last year, I feel like the way we've been able to really focus and really come up with a strategy that makes sense, that's true to like what we're able to do and what the real problems are. There's no kind of wishful thinking in that. And then get everyone motivated around that has been really, really satisfying, inspiring. And I think the difference it makes in terms of being really clear on what we're trying to do, and have made some hard decisions in terms of the vision and like who we're prioritizing and team things that need to be done to match that, I think that's probably been the biggest win. I think in terms of the biggest mistake, I don't know. I think there are a few things that haunt me over the years. One would be that we had a couple of projects just before COVID, which we ran in a kind of all or nothing type way. So the opposite of agile, the opposite of kind of shipping incremental value, where we basically started the project. We committed to doing it all. So it was like one of them was a big kind of rebrand website rebuild. The other was effectively rebuilding the dashboard engine that allows you to, the way the dashboards are created, you lay them out and resize them. And both of those projects were coupled to each other. They were also all or nothing type things. Well, both of them were rebuilds. Rebuilds are always really dangerous because you end up underestimating how much time and effort is to rebuild the things that you need. You can't just jettison them. And I think both of those really, I think we lost a lot of time and energy and momentum from doing those. And like we've enshrined in our, you know, when we reset our values afterwards, we've enshrined that we will never do anything like that ever again. But I think that was probably one of the best. And having those conversations like, should we start? And we kind of felt, oh, we kind of knew we should, but we didn't want to because it would have been real upheaval or anything. That kind of sunk cost type feeling with it. Yeah, that's probably the biggest thing. And then the other one would be just like, these ones where maybe, you know, it's not been the right fit and you just left that too long and it's kind of causing other secondary issues.
Yeah. All right. Okay. I mean, it's always a learning. I just like to ask those questions as, you know, like kind of an example of like what can you learn from, right? But yeah, the last one is always about a hack and, you know, it can be anything. I know that you've got a coach and that kind of shaped you and the way you manage the company a little bit. So maybe that could be your hack and, you know, happy to talk about that too.
Yeah, I think so. A few people recommended to me, hey, Tom, I've got a coach. It's really good. You should try it too. And I found it extraordinarily valuable. It's different to having a manager. The coach is out there entirely for you and they push you and make you scrub. Well, my mindset is it makes you scrub a little bit if there's something I'm uncomfortable about but it's really good kind of time to self-reflect and hold yourself accountable. But also like, you know, I'm someone who always looks at what's the next problem as well. And I think having someone there remind you that like all this progress you're making as well is very useful and kind of just helps network you. Like if there's something that you don't know how to deal with, like putting you in the right place or kind of a situation you've not dealt with before, being able to draw on their experience, I think has been really enormously valuable. What are other ones? I think like I've never been a natural networker, but actually I quite enjoy it. I wouldn't say I'm an introvert, but I wouldn't be someone who kind of thrives for that, where I feel like afterwards I need a kind of bit of my own time afterwards, but actually I really do enjoy it. I think the value again of that kind of serendipitous networking, like the number of times that you kind of meet someone that you half know and then like you've then formed a better connection and that opens doors, I think is really important. And it's the ideas you get. So I think, I think most people are better than I would have been, but I think that's really important. Another thing is vision. I think I was always, I grew up on the Lean Startup book and you know, my career. And I always felt like that meant that you should kind of go where you're being pulled in terms of how customers are reacting to what you put out there and stuff. But you really can't work like that forever. Like, you have to listen. You have to be putting things out there and learning, but you also have to hold true to a vision. And they go like, look, I believe that there's something in this. And you need to take the information as it's coming back to you and learn from that. But if you're always kind of giving up on the first attempt or listening to what you're hearing too literally, then you won't get anywhere. And I think like big change, big ambitious improvements, like building something great, you do need to carry your convictions there and not just kind of take too naive a view over just getting that feedback and acting on it. You have to apply your lens. I've seen kind of more junior people and kind of product and engineering sometimes, you know, they've gone to use test and someone said something and they've literally taken exactly what that person's literally and or put something out there that they're not even that confident themselves with the view that, oh, if it gets validated by users, it's okay or not. It's like, no, you can't replace vision and belief and design competence purely with just getting feedback. That you have to. And the importance as well for, because in a business, there's all these other decisions going on all the time that people are making. You know, is this actually a problem we need to deal with and how they solve those problems? And if you haven't got the vision to go, well, this is where we're going, and like everyone isn't aware of that, then they'll make decisions that don't make sense to that. They'll be optimizing for getting, you know, millions of customers rather than thousands that are paying lots of money, or trying to scale something that you've got there's a very unlikely chance that you're going to be working on that because there isn't that vision. So I think that's been really useful more recently. It's going to be much clearer over what we're trying to do, not just we're agile or react, kind of like this is where we think we're going. And again, it probably sounds really bloody obvious, but for us, we didn't do that for quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter in this part. Yeah, again, a lot of things are kind of obvious. You look back at it, like sometimes I think about marketing and I'm like, good God, this is just common sense. But yeah, when you think about it, when you start kind of dig deeper and you're like, oh yeah, but like I needed that reminder, or like somebody else in my team needed that reminder, although we kind of deal with it every day and it's that easy on the surface. But yeah, thank you. It's a great reminder. So thank you for sharing it. And thank you for the conversation. I absolutely loved it. I think you've got a hell of a story there and a lot of great valuable learnings. So yeah, thanks for sharing them here. And hopefully we'll get to do it again sometime to reflect on what you just said and see what's ahead.
That'd be great. Well, thanks a lot, Anna. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Tom, and take care.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.